Accession number 14974, Paul Armstrong, reel 7.
Mr. Paul Armstrong, reel 7. We were discussing duties of a subaltern, Mr. Armstrong. Were there any other duties that you had to do other than the ones we've already discussed?
Yes. One very interesting thing. The Durham Light Infantry were believed in very aggressive fighting training. And this included patrols. And patrols, as far as the subaltern's concerned, generally speaking, mean taking a section out, probably including your sergeant, but generally led by yourself, in which case one has to probe the enemy lines to get information, hopefully to get a prisoner as well, but information. And so in the dark nights that we had at the time we were training, one had regularly to take out different sections, 1, 2 and 3 sections in turn, on aggressive patrolling. And in a lot of cases, these were monitored by people from other companies or from headquarters. And I may say the adjutant was very, very active in observing that these patrols were carried out to the best of your ability. And what happened there was you were given a piece of ground in which you had to advance. You were told where the enemy line was supposed to be. There were people there from another company who acted as the enemy, and if you reached them before you were seen, then you were making a good patrol. If you were seen before you reached them, it was a black mark. And the men took it in good part. It was fun to them when they understood what it meant. Some of the subalterns went as far as to stand them a pint each if they carried out a successful patrol. Others just said, well done. In any case, it was very, very much a matter of learning to do something on which your life would probably depend fairly soon.
Did you mask up for patrols?
No, in those days, no. None of that was done. All we did was to... It's a very cold area, Oxford, in the winter. Extremely cold. And generally you were allowed to wear balaclavas and gloves and the rest of it, but otherwise no, we in those days, I suppose, we weren't sufficiently sophisticated in war to realize that this sort of thing was necessary if you were not to show yourself to the enemy. Again, it shows how untrained, how raw we were. I can't remember doing any more than just section patrols, but I understand later on this was a case where bigger patrols took place. It depended on what you wanted to know. And generally speaking, it was A, where the enemy were, and B, could you pick up a prisoner? That, I think, is the extent of individual trainee of the platoon officer, except this business of getting your troops onto vehicles and getting your troops off vehicles, and this was practiced as often as possible. You also took part in marches, forced marches, route marches, various types of march, daytime and nighttime, to acclimatise your troops to moving in a hurry. Generally speaking, during these marches, we kept to, in the night time, we kept to marching in threes because of traffic. But later on, of course, we had to do night marches without this sort of formation.
The pace of a forced march, was it light infantry pace?
Yes. We moved always at 120, except ceremonial, which was 140. And one of the engaging pastimes of the Durhams is that at the end of a route march, of whatever duration, whatever distance, one was expected to come in at the double. And the double in the light infantry is fairly speedy. This tested us quite severely, as it was meant to do.
It's quite a lot of strain on a men's feet to march at that pace over a great distance.
Training means a lot. I was in the infantry for a long time, and at various occasions, well, when I was with the 2nd Durhams, every 3 weeks we had to do 100 miles in 3 days and finish up in precisely the same way, and I never had a blister. But I must say that one of the things that was insisted on in the infantry was man management, which included the inspection of your men's feet as soon as it finished the march. Frequently before that, when your men were parading, you would ask them to sit down, take off the boots and examine the socks and the feet before they started, because sometimes they didn't bother. The average soldier is very brave, very willing, but tends to be a little bit casual if he can get away with it.
On the areas of tactics, tactical training, what were you getting there in Oxfordshire?
Moving over country. It's an interesting thing that I now recollect. I didn't at the time appreciate, but we went in for quite a considerable amount of training in withdrawals, which are the hardest operation to carry out. They are terribly difficult because advancing, you feel there's a certain amount of elan, a certain amount of adrenaline flowing because you're advancing against an enemy. But a withdrawal is the opposite. And it's not easy to be able to control your men. The tendency is to be flurried, and you have to wait until the people who've leapfrogged you over have settled, and then you can vacate the position you occupy and move beyond them into another position. Your rear guard, who are finding positions all the time, have to be very, very good. And many times you find that you're left desperately trying to find somewhere that will make us an adequate position to cover your people who are withdrawing onto you, and yet protect yourself. It's in retrospect, I feel that our training was better than I thought at the time, because clearly the regular army people had envisaged that possibility that we might have to do what happened in the First War, and that was withdraw. We came then from company onto battalion exercises, which were precisely the same as I've pictured for a platoon, for a company, and then for a battalion. It moves the same way, except you've got other arms, and excuse me, and you've got headquarters, you've got all the ancillary services operating with you. And unfortunately, at that time, we were very restricted with equipment. The expansion of the services had been so fast that ordnance couldn't cope. And so all weapons, everything possible had to go to the people who were already in France and Belgium. Well, they weren't allowed into Belgium, but France and on the borders of Belgium before that. And I should say myself that we were overjoyed when eventually we got some Canadian Ross rifles, which I think probably were relics, being carefully kept in Greece, of course, but just relics. And when one saw the weapons that the Germans had, one felt a little bit let down.
Had you Bren guns as well by this point in time?
At that time, yes. We had our complement of Bren guns, and we were all officers, well, company officers included, were all expected to be able to fire, to strip, reassemble, and do this day and at night. And once again, it's the sort of thing that one does very carefully, because one never knows when this is going to be required. A lot of bayonet training was carried out because the Derhams believe in aggressive warfare. And if you think of the fact that the Derhams were in every theatre of war, you'll realise, and they had the most battalions of any other regiment of the army, you'll realise that their fighting qualities were appreciated.
What form did bayonet training take?
There is, how shall I describe, a framework from which is suspended sacks filled with straw and marked out in the name of a person. And one had to advance, preferably uphill, to make one tired, and then go into the advance and position and literally attack the dummy as though it were a person, with the sergeant majors and other experienced personnel standing by, pointing out where one failed and where one didn't. And it's an interesting thing that later on in the war, when they realised that at the end of a bayonet charge, by the time one reaches the enemy and has covered a certain amount of ground, which may be bad, which may be on rising ground, which may be anything, the attacker is fairly well winded and therefore has to be in the peak of condition. And later, they used to establish battle schools where there were obstacle courses made, in which you were advanced over fences, over through tunnels, crawled under barbed wire, carried out various things. Generally speaking, had to attack on upward rising ground, and then attack a dummy. And
you didn't have that facility at this stage of the war?
No, no. It was purely and simply the sort of things that our NCOs put together to enable us to practice this occupation.
Your divisional commander was quite an aggressive soldier, I believe. And particularly had a very high opinion of mobility.
Yes.
And this was a mobile division.
That's right.
What form did your transport take in those very early days?
But at the very early days, our transport consisted of our feet. It was rather later when this mobility was brought in. Jackie Churchill was our brigadier, and he was a very aggressive man. In fact, all the senior officers in our division were aggressive. And the divisional commander had spent his whole army career agitating for more transport, and more tanks and other weapons for the army, but he firmly believed in Lorraine infantry, having obviously observed what the Germans had. It was clear enough. But don't forget, all the years before, and I was one of the people who doubted the likelihood of war because I was seduced by the League of Nations. I, in my naivety, believed that countries could live together and settle things. I should have known from history that it wasn't possible, that as long as a person thinks they can conquer another person, they will try.
What was the commanding general's name?
Martel.
Did you meet him?
No, no, strangely enough. The last parade I was on, which would be at Christmas in 39, His Majesty came to inspect us, and we were all assembled, and the general was escorting His Majesty, and we were formed up as a brigade. And I remember the king went to the trouble. It was bitingly cold, and he looked very, very weary and literally worn out. He went to the trouble of shaking hands with and speaking to every officer, certainly on parade in my battalion, and I believe in every battalion. We thought very, very highly of him for a thing like that. It's such bitterly cold weather.
Was he a very imposing or impressive figure, the king?
No, he just looked like the average, frankly, the average general officer. An interesting thing I noticed about generals was brigadiers and ordinary divisional commanders were generally big and imposing people, but the higher the rank, the smaller they become. And when one got to a corps commander, he was generally a wee chap with bandy legs. Very interesting. I always wondered why. Mind, General Gort and General Ironside were both very large and very tough people. Exceptions to prove the rule.
Moving into Oxfordshire and the days and weeks that followed, how did you get on with the population, civilian population?
Terribly kindly. But I must say that our troops make themselves popular wherever they go. They're very well behaved, and they have a certain charm about them that seems to take them through any country and any circumstances. As far as discipline was concerned, I was very fortunate. I knew most of my platoon pretty well. As I think I told you, my sergeant was an ex-poacher, so he was a countryman. And we were more a family than I could have really expected. They, in one way, tried to help me as much as they could. Our platoon was stationed in an old warehouse. It had been an old scrap warehouse, and it was made pretty comfortable. It was on three stories, and the chaps found their own amusement, because Chipping Norton's not a large place, but I believe that each platoon in the company found themselves an area where they were welcome, and one didn't like to interfere with that. Apart from that, being so far away from, how shall I put it, a large centre of interest, as Oxford was quite a distance away, they used to spend a lot of time inside playing cards. And one of the unfortunate things about playing cards is that there are many people lose many, a lot of money, and there are one or two who make a lot of money. And I used to have a running battle with this evil of the cards. And it was rather a point of amusement to see how I could catch them and how they could evade my visits. And I think my best time was they were on the second floor of this warehouse, and whilst they were out training, I got my batman to get me, no, I didn't even tell him a batman, I got my lance sergeant to get me a ladder and to loosen the unlock the catch of one of the windows, and waited until they had ample time to build up a large kitty, and then I sprang through the window, seized all the money in the kitty, and said, "You are A, B, C, D on a charge," and put them on a fizzer, which meant that they went to the CO for judgment. That money went to buy a few improvements for the welfare of the men. It wasn't that I wanted it, it was to stamp out this evil, which will never, ever be stamped out where Englishmen gather.
Those cards was an offence.
Yes. It is a game of housey-housey organised by the whole battalion, and in, for example, in an affy or a place like that, is perfectly legal. But private cards generally meant that men who, don't forget at that time, their pay was very little, and the average man was only taking, the average married man was only taking 7 shillings per week. And in a game of cards, 7 shillings doesn't last very far. And most of the men liked to drink, and almost inevitably, most of them were smokers. In those days, one was encouraged to smoke because it kept up the morale. What would be said nowadays about this, I shudder to think. So that you have put then a man into the position that he loses money that he can ill afford, and a man who is in that position, who can't afford to drink and can't afford to smoke, is liable to get into trouble. And as far as trouble's concerned, it meant that some clash with the civilian population would take place, and this would be a very black mark against the regiment.
This didn't occur though where you were. You didn't have this situation.
No, I stamped on it. But it did occur in different places. One couldn't eliminate it altogether. And as I say, I was very fortunate in my platoon.
Were there other activities that the men could do or get into which were frowned upon? I'm thinking particularly, for example, the local ladies. Were they?
Oh, yes, indeed. There were many, many, how shall I put, engagements announced. There were marriages carried out. There was all sorts of romances. This was inevitable because the people of Chipping Norton tried very hard to put on social evenings and various other pastimes for the troops. And so, of course, the girls naturally were fascinated by the uniforms and by the fact that these were from the frozen north, and very, very different people. and could be very charming people. Yes, that was one thing that did happen and which we didn't discourage.
How did how was a man able to become engaged and married? Did he have to have the commanding officer's approval to this?
It didn't. It used to happen in the regular army in pre-war days, but no, it didn't happen during the war. They were allowed to do what they wished to do, provided, of course, A, that they weren't married beforehand, and B, that it wasn't just a question of playing on somebody's heart for no particular reason.
You mentioned the fact that the accommodation was in a warehouse of some kind and became quite comfortable through time. The food situation was a responsibility to you as an officer to check on the food and the quality?
We had our own cook and defaulters, because there always were defaulters, in spite of what I say. There were daily defaulters. The men who couldn't keep the equipment clean, the men who were late on parade, the men who were dirty on parade. There are many things. Defaulters can happen. People who don't look after their equipment, that was stamped on. So, of course, one carried Army Form 252 in the top pocket, ready to issue a fitter against anyone defaulting. And so the cook had generally at least two people to help him. Help generally meant peeling masses of potatoes, but and heating the water, which was generally done in a very, very primitive cookhouse. And the regimental quartermaster sergeant issued the food in bulk to the companies, and the company quartermaster sergeant issued them to the platoons. And it came to us, and we were trained in living. This was to train our troops for living in the field, and we cooked there and then in the platoon. We had to watch this very carefully, and the platoon commander always had to supervise every meal to see that A, it was up to standard, and B, that everyone got the share. And the sergeant accompanied all of these inspections.
You mentioned men there on charges of one kind or another. Who dished out that discipline to them?
Simple charges like dirty equipment and things of that nature were settled by the company commander, the major commanding the company. He had his little orderly room each day when he saw defaulters. If he thought that it was something that he couldn't handle, it was sent up to the colonel, and he generally had a defaulters each morning. So it seemed to work pretty well. The sort of thing the colonel would see would be people who'd been absent without leave, and in the odd case we had people, well, absent without leave covered a lot of ills. There was no desertion as such in those days, but you had chaps whose wife wrote pathetic letters telling him of problems, probably with in-laws, and they used to, without thinking of asking, just scamper off home and then realise what they'd done and come back to face the music. One of the unfortunate things I thought about the army in those days was what some of these more heinous crimes, the wife suffered as well. There was a stoppage of pay to the wife as well as the soldier, which I thought was rather unfair, because although the average soldier would never do a thing that would affect his wife. There were certain hard cases that when they were drunk, they didn't care what they did and who was affected.